This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrain Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Permissions versus rewards.
Toronto versus raccoons.
And me versus Michigan's book supply. Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the Gaming Hut. And today in the Gaming Hut, we've got our books, we got our minis, we got our dice, we got everything we need. But do we? Do we have everything we need? We certainly don't have everything we want. I guess in order to get everything we need, we have to accomplish something. We have to achieve a thing, and then maybe we'll get what we want. That's the structure of classic role-playing, maybe the structure of all role-playing. We'll learn that in this segment. But things that we want to get, those are rewards, and things that we need to get, maybe to move through the story or maybe to get to the rewards, those are what you're calling permissions, right, Robin? These are two different sorts of benefits that you get as player characters. Am I on the beam?
Right. So let's start with the dichotomy here. And it turns out to be a trichotomy, sort of near the end.
Oh, no. Spoiler. We've already got an exceptions and we haven't even laid the rule out yet.
Right. But the point of this is often when I'm writing a scenario, I will find a situation where the players can think to do something, whether or not they're using a skill where they have a chance of failure and can succeed. And then sometimes the question is, do they know that they've succeeded? And I think we as GMs and as scenario designers will often let the players succeed without the necessary transparency for the players to feel good about having done that. And so that's what I want to signpost in this segment, is making sure that people feel that there's an actual upbeat when they prevail. And so I have divided the sorts of successes that you get from successful skill use or just making a correct decision into two categories. Permissions. These are things that give you permission to do something else, to move further into the story. And then rewards, something that doesn't change whether you move into the story or not, but is some other good or useful thing. So examples of permission are you gain an audience with the queen who normally would not speak to adventurers like you, or you find a secret passage, or you open a locked door, or discover the presence of a door, or you reach the next place in the adventure. And that's where we sort of get into the arduous journey, right? Is how much is it going to cost you to finally reach the plateau of Lang? And some of these are things that you, I think, would think, oh, yeah, the players will be super stoked to have achieved all of these milestones. But if the adventure depends on them getting there, and the question is just whether they get there in a costly fashion or easily, do the players really feel that? Do they kind of in the back of their minds suspect, well, eventually we're going to get to have to talk to the queen because she's the one who has the mission. What kind of...
Right. Or eventually we'll have to get to Lang because on the cover of the adventure, it says terror in Lang.
Exactly. And so do the players feel that they have won something by gaining permission to do something? And even calling it permission sort of suggests that, oh, well, I guess it's, you know, maybe that's not so exciting. And of course, it's even worse if they fail to get permission to do something and you make the story more annoying and boring because of that, which I think is a separate issue from this. Mm-hmm. And I think traditionally we have over invested in permissions on the idea that, well, if you have an ability, you need to roll it. So you have your persuasion ability. So naturally you have to persuade the chancellor to let you in to talk to the queen. And I think we've overvalued the extent to which players feel a sense of accomplishment when they simply get permission to do what the story demands them to do. Rewards, on the other hand, are other things that they can use in the course either of the adventure or in the campaign. And so the most obvious thing there is like a bonus on an upcoming action, so that if you get permission to talk to the queen, but you do it exceptionally well, you are going to also get a bonus the next time you talk to the chancellor or something like that. A clue is a reward, a piece of information that you need in order to put the puzzle together, because you don't necessarily need clues of most types, except core clues in Gumshoe, to move into the story, but you need information to know what's going on. And so that's something, understanding is something I think that players are immediately gratified by. Many games, of course, money, loot, yeah, gold. And the downstream version of that, gear, stuff, especially stuff that you can't buy with money.
Right, yes. Magic items, etc.
It's immediately gratifying to get that. Things that I think that we undervalue as rewards for players are simply the praise of sympathetic characters. That if you come out of the dungeon holding the head of the dragon, and then the villagers all surround you and cheer and celebrate you and take you to the tavern, that feels like a victory that then doubles the victory that you had when you finally, you know, killed the dragon and cut its head off. And that's something that we don't think to do as GMs a lot, just because there usually isn't a skill of, you know, initiate praise sequence. But, mm-hmm, you know, in a movie, when the heroes succeed to a point that sometimes annoys me, there's often a crowd of people clapping for them. And so you can certainly have that happen in a scenario. Information that you can use to gain advantages over people. Players love that and see that and understand it. And so that's something where they are not only gratified to get the information, but they are looking forward to what they can do with it. So a reward that also implies a future action, I think, is very powerful. And of course, you know, actually achieving the main goal of the mission, that is immediately rewarding in a way that requires no further explanation or additional rules or development or thought. And if the objective is to explain a mystery, to find out what's going on, the moment when everything dawns on you and go, oh, this is what's clearly happening, you get, I think, a couple of jolts from that. One, when people at the table first put things together, that feels very rewarding. And also, when they have it confirmed at the end that that's, they were right. So mm-hmm, again, that's like a double reward.
Yeah, especially when the bad guy like is mad at them for being right and foiling his plan.
Yes, exactly.
The opposite of praise, I guess.
The opposite of praise.
The scorn of bad people who hate you.
Yes. The pouting and sulking of your defeated enemies. Lamentations, yes, even, shall we say.
As it were. Yes.
As it were. And you can sort of turn a permission into a reward by just setting it up as hard, right? If you just say, well, you're going to have to gain an audience with the queen, and then they do, okay, sure, fine. Well, the queen hasn't spoken to an adventurer for 17 years. So setting it up as hard and then allowing them to win, I think, sort of turns a permission into more of a reward, especially, again, if there's an additional benefit on top of just getting to move into the story.
or even if, you know, you don't allow them to win, but they actually win. It's as a result of a gladiatorial combat or an archery contest or a, you know, a human chess game or a magic duel with the court magician. Those are local wins, which are satisfying. And then the win that opens the bigger permission that adds another layer onto the quality of the reward. And I guess that sort of implies that rewards can be layered. So if the gear comes with a clue to the mystery, or if, you know, the money comes with a permission, a thing that you can use to advance the plot in a way that, you know, you find the ring, the signet ring of the most powerful family in the city, and you say, we can use this to get an audience with them and maybe get their patronage. That's, you know, a layered reward is another good way. And I guess the reward that I would add to praise is, in some games, players value, or rather at some tables, players value a deeper connection with a given NPC. And so that might be you win the love of the Fair Marguerite, or it might be, you know, you have the respect of the local high priest. You have the FBI guy who will now slip you confidential files in your fight against werewolves. It's not as generic as praise, but it is something that will make the play of that game more emotionally satisfying, and maybe also set up, you know, clues and opportunities and permissions for a given player character or for the party as a whole.
Right. And if, again, that comes with a suggestion of a future advantage, right, that one thing you could do is, if cementing your relationships to a cast of characters is a feature of this game, is you've won over the FBI guy, write him in your character sheet list of contacts as someone mm-hmm. that you can draw on later, perhaps even in a later case. And so anything that can go on your character sheet definitely feels like a reward. You're writing it on your character sheet. That's why they call it character sheet. And
right.
even sort of more ephemeral things, I think if you, for example, if your success in winning over the queen gives you an advantage that you can use later, you can even just, you know, hand somebody an index card that says, you know, you've won the queen's favor. Here's something that you can hold up and argue me into giving you a bonus for later. And so I guess making these rewards concrete in some way, where concrete means a notation on a card or your character sheet, I think helps to make it more obvious that you've won something, just the way that you'd write, if you got a bag of holding, you'd put that in your character sheet. And so more ephemeral things, whether they're permanent, like an alliance, or temporary, like the favor of the queen, they are things that once you make them clearer to the players that that they've achieved something, they feel that sense of a reward, even for something that might otherwise be a permission.
I think that notion of something that's on an index card, not to derail this discussion, but I'm going to derail the discussion a little bit, is a really good technology for playing political intrigue games, which are often very, very hard. First of all, for the players to keep track of. Second of all, to figure out, do I have enough influence? Do I have enough leverage? Do I have enough of the other guy's secrets that I can advance my goal? Maybe the game has a formal system for it, like Vampire. Maybe it doesn't, but maybe it's just a cons pyramid type structure, like in Knights Black Agents. But I think your notion of writing down the information you can leverage on an index card and giving it to them, and then they keep it like they would keep their list of solid gold goodies, their loot list, that I think will make it easier for the players to sort of fan out their influence cards and say, oh, look, we have leverage with these guys, and these guys. What can we do? Maybe that works even better in conjunction with a string map or a cons pyramid map. But the notion that you have these physical referable things that, even if they don't say +2 on influence rolls, that still give the players a notion of where they can apply pressure validly and where they can maybe need to shore it up by suborning a different guy.
Right. And now we come to the third part of the dichotomy, the trichotomy part. The hardest thing to convey a sense of reward for is the opt-out. And that is something where you gain an advantage of something bad not happening. And this can be simply because in your planning session, you picked the right route. You didn't even necessarily use an ability to have to do this. Or you used one of the many abilities that you use to forestall bad things happening. So escaping the file room without being seen, right? So successful stealth roll. That is implicit in having gotten out without being seen, that you won something because you know that you succeeded at your role, but it's also a bit of a non-event. And so if there you say, well, you hear the treads of the security guard coming down the hall, and then you make your stealth roll, and then you still get away, you've introduced the possibility of failure so that the success feels like something instead of feeling like a nothing. Or, you know, you detect the presence of enemies up ahead plotting an ambush against you. That means that they don't get to use surprise on you. Maybe if you then succeed at yet another roll, you get to use surprise on them. But the absence of their surprise advantage is kind of ephemeral. And so you want to make sure that somehow the players feel that they got something really useful out of spotting those bad guys. It's like, oh, well, if you hadn't seen them coming, they would have leapt on you and half of you would be dead, right? So don't forget to underline, even just verbally, the advantage of not having been caught out. Or you go to the queen and she likes you so much that she doesn't put you through the horrible test of iron, where you're subjected to terrible heat and hit with testing mallets. And the way to do that is, you know, you see the guys coming out of the audience who have been hit with the testing mallets. Show in some way, allow the players to picture the bad thing that they avoided. Or when you know, see enemies up on the ridge and there's no particular advantage in fighting them, which is hard to put across in a system that gives you experience points for any fight you get into. So you might even at this point indicate, well, this is a useless fight to get into, so you're not going to get experience if you get into it. But again, making it somehow clear to people that the non-event was an advantage, that you picked the right branch. And that's one of the most difficult things to convey in a scenario, right? If there's or a scenario that sort of turns that on its head, which is not something I recommend, and makes it like whether the creature makes its alertness check and spots you or not. Well, how does it feel like a victory if the GM rolled behind a screen and the basilisk didn't spot you and nothing happened and you didn't spot the basilisk? You've got to find some way to show that that was kind of a victory. And so, you know, it's always better to turn that on its head and make that a stealth roll for the players than a detect roll from the creature.
Yeah, the real trick with any of these is to establish the alternative in a credible way. And that can be with a legend, that can be with just, there's a lot of statues in this dungeon all of a sudden for the basilisk, or it can be, as you say, you see the guys leaving the queen's audience chamber having been struck with the testing mallet. But before we are struck with the testing mallet, we should leave this chamber and enter a beautiful advertisement and then another hut. I want high fantasy investigative adventure.
But Ken, there's only one of you.
I got you there. You are a GM, Robin.
You do have me there.
And a GM and a player is all you need for Paragon Blade, the gumshoe one-to-one game of swords and spells.
In the Paragon Blade from fantasy master Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, you play a hero in a fantastical land, still scarred by the evil of the fallen hellbound empire.
Mystery and magic collide in tales of conspiratorial wizards, monstrous foes, and arcane intrigue.
Gather your wits, your allies, and your blade.
Three advantages see you through the perils that await.
A trusty companion, a wise mentor, a stalwart servant, or cryptic ally.
A relic from the dark days of old, a treacherous artifact of terrible power.
And most of all, you're a hero of great skill and insight. You'll read the riddle of this broken world and battle evil in all its many forms.
Paragon Blade includes all the rules you need for an intense head-to-head experience in the fantasy vein.
Plus, detailed guidance on building your own heroes and quests.
Fits superbly with virtual tabletops.
Comes with three scenarios with the heroes designed to plumb their mysteries.
Barbarian hero Khan the Unslain must race against time to seek a cure for a demonic curse in Heart of the Beast.
Alethea the Scholar Keller must conceal her sorcerer's powers from her father, the magistrate, while helping him investigate the Isle of Death.
Puck the Thief must steal the Jar of Doom before anyone else opens it.
Paragon Blade, now available at the Palgrain web store.
Or at a discerning game retailer near you. It's time once again to ask Ken and Robin. So let's ask Ken and Robin. Beloved Patreon backer Andrew Bates asks Robin, or actually sort of hectors Robin, but eventually a question mark appears. I'm disappointed, says Andrew, that after 700 plus episodes, I had to learn from another source that Toronto is the raccoon capital of the world. Perhaps you did not realize that the rest of us are not constantly besieged by rapid trash pandas. Toronto paid $31 million for raccoon-resistant bins that do not resist raccoons. Have you personally suffered raccoon rampage? Leaving aside the fact that Raccoon Rampage sounds like a great board game, Robin, what's the skinny? I'm pretty sure we've mentioned the Darling Raccoons of Toronto, but I guess we haven't indicated their iconic status in Canada's fairest city. What's going on?
Right. So it is widely agreed upon that this is not just lore, that Toronto does have much higher raccoon density than other cities. What is somewhat mysterious is exactly why that is. Mm-hmm. And not mysterious in the way that, you know, pyramid power is mysterious, but in the way that nobody's gotten enough big enough grant to come up with a final definitive answer. But at any rate, raccoons are a big issue here in Toronto. We have raccoons living around our apartment, and therefore I do have raccoon stories to get to later. The city of Toronto gets around 17,000 raccoon-related service calls every year. That's mostly carcass pickup because unlike a smaller animal like a squirrel or a rat or a bird, which, you know, even on a sidewalk, natural decomp is going to take care of, a raccoon is a pretty large animal. And so
yep,
you pretty much have to send somebody with a shovel to come and pick up a raccoon that's been hit by a car, which is something that happens relatively frequently. And so the question, why Toronto, has sort of an answer, but it's one that I find unsatisfying. And the sort of the answer is that we were fairly early in adopting an organic recycling program. As Andrew mentions, the original first wave of designs of green bins were not as resistant to raccoons as their designers had hoped.
Yeah.
This, of course, is hilarious that they had to redesign it. But also, I don't know how on earth you would test the raccoon proofness of an organic recycling bin except by putting it out in the wild, because what are you going to do? Put out a bunch of bins with a bunch of raccoons and see if they can open it? The thing is that raccoons have hands and they're very clever, and
they're
the first one they could sort of turn it and knock it over. And so they, one with more of a lock mechanism was put in place. Of course, the more complicated the lock mechanism, the more it will defeat humans attempting to put things in the bins.
There's a great line that the rangers at Yellowstone say, which is that the smartest bear is smarter than the stupidest tourist. And right. So it's very hard to do bear proofing.
Yes. And certainly any animal is more determined to get at a food source than you are to keep them out of it.
A nicer way to put it, I guess.
Right. Well, the other thing is also true, but that doesn't make sense to me. And let me preface my coming explanation of why Toronto with the disclaimer that I am not a licensed raccoonologist. This is just me trying to fill a theoretical gap in why we have all these raccoons, because other cities also have food waste, and cities that don't have a compost program have the food waste just in garbage, and garbage bins are no more raccoon proofable than organic recyclables. Like, possibly we are, you know, helping them a little by putting it all in one place in an exciting enrichment program for them to test and open. Incidentally, the new way that the more raccoon proof bins are defeated is an alliance with squirrels. So squirrels will, if you say to a squirrel, well, there's no way you're getting into this abundant food source, you'd have to chew your way through a millimeter of plastic. And the squirrel will say, I'm a rodent. I got to chew in order to live.
I chew through bark, son. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. I'll chew through houses. I can chew through this bin. And so sometimes a squirrel will chew a hole in the top of it, and then raccoons can take advantage of that. I think there are two additional things about Toronto that account for our raccoon density. And one is our abundant lawns and green space, because apart from human garbage, such as eggs, fleshy fruits like grapes or nuts and vegetables, apparently they really like corn, the main food source for raccoons is grubs. And that's why they're active mostly at night. And one thing that is different from Toronto to most other comparable cities is we have lots of not just parks, but lawns that we have big areas of the city, including the one that I live in, where there's originally single family or two family dwellings. Now, a lot of them have been turned into additional units with rentals, but there's lots of just regular kind of houses with lawns. And where there's a lawn, there's grubs. And where there's grubs, there's raccoons coming out at night to feast. The other feature that Toronto has that other cities don't necessarily in the downtown core is separate sort of shack-like garages that are not attached to the house, but the alleyway behind the house. And that is a perfect habitat for a raccoon. Raccoons are very territorial. They exist in relatively small territories. And often they move from nest to nest. Typically, the raccoon moms will move their kids around a bunch of different times just to be careful. And so the garage adds another couple different places where raccoons can live in a small downtown area. And so I think it's the lawns and the green space plus those garages that account for our extreme raccoon density.
Well, to your point, it turns out that Chicago is also very heavily raccooned. We also have lawns. We have, I think, a little less intentional green space. There's a good amount. But as against that, we've got lots of river, and so places for the racks to hang out. And we also, of course, have ample garbage. We don't bother locking our garbage lids because, as you point out, that just gets squirrels involved. I don't have raccoons in my yard, but I've seen them in yards in my neighborhood, certainly. And yeah, everything that you say about Toronto is true from a raccoon's point of view, I think, mostly. In Chicago, we certainly have lots of alleys and detached garages, as you mentioned. A quick check indicated that raccoons are also surprisingly present in Indianapolis. So maybe it's just the presence of gamers that draws raccoons. I don't know.
Yeah, it's their enthusiasm for Magic the Gathering that accounts for their high density here.
They love Doritos. That's what it is.
The city of Toronto has the following raccoon recommendations. Never feed raccoons. That's generally what authorities will advise with wild animals. Also, do not approach raccoons and touch them, even if they appear tame, sick, or injured. They're just trying to trick you. Properly dispose of waste on your property in your waste bins. There you go. Raccoons will eat garbage left on the ground and compost. And always make sure to take your green bin and garbage containers to the curb in the morning of pickup and not the night before. This is useless.
Yes, no.
What do you mean the raccoon
that.
Is going to... Where else? Where is your green bin? It's going to be in your alleyway. It's not inside right. your house. And as we've already mentioned, if it's in your garage, that's where they live. So where mm-hmm. the green bin in is of no consequence to the raccoons. If you have raccoons in your house, to get them out, hang vinegar-soaked rags. They don't like that. And also play a loud radio tuned to an all-talk station. So raccoons hate talk radio, apparently.
Yeah.
And I guess you need someone with, you know, sort of an annoying voice. So, you know, an Alex Jones or somebody like that. One thing I also need to add is, however, they love podcasts. They like a nice calming podcast. They really enjoy our podcast. So
yeah,
our podcast will not drive raccoons out of your house. The reason to take all of this seriously, in addition to just not wanting to have to shovel up your rotting food waste when they chunk your bins over in your alleyway, is that they carry a couple of diseases. Rabies sometimes, more often canine distemper, a disease that can then get into pets and kill them. And there's also roundworm in their poop. So they're a danger to humans. City recommends that when you're disposing of raccoon poop, that you either bury it or burn it. And neither of those are options that Valerie and I have available to us.
Right.
We do not have a lawn in the house that we rent a portion of. And certainly, if we did burn raccoon poop, the very same city would be around pretty quick, I think, to yep. Remonstrate with us. Raccoons, as I mentioned, are super territorial, and they have very small territories and often have 4 to 6 dens within a tiny space. People who want a humane solution to raccoons will go, well, why not just relocate them? Why not take them out to the woods? Well, that means that you're setting up a deadly battle with whatever raccoons currently live there. As I just said, territorial, they'll fight and kill each other. So
why not be humane to the Huns? Just take them to Europe.
Urban raccoons, it turns out, have shorter snouts, and that is in a bid to appear cuter and perhaps qualify them for this thing they've heard of called being a pet. And every expert on raccoons says, do not make them pets. Raccoons beg to differ. If you've ever followed a raccoon account where they have pictures of cute raccoons, many of them are clearly pets. Now, apparently, according to our local expert on raccoons, Suzanne McDonald of York University, my alma mater, says that we do not have this phenomenon in Toronto because, unlike the U.S. South, people do not hunt raccoons here. People in other parts of North America hunt raccoons for sport and sometimes even eating. In Ontario, no one would think to do either of those two things. So our raccoon snouts are not different between urban and wilderness environments. But other raccoons are becoming more kawaii due to the natural hunting selection of people, I guess, deciding not to shoot the really cute raccoons.
And things that I have never wished as a cat owner is I wish my cat were larger, smarter, and had prehensile hands. Never wished that.
If Warren was a raccoon, you would have no hope of keeping the milk out of the in the refrigerator away from him.
The refrigerator would just always be open.
Yes.
It'd be a nightmare.
And also, if Warren was a raccoon, he would chew through your sheetrock and live in the walls, which, again, you perhaps don't want.
Don't want that.
Yeah. Also, urban raccoons are better at problem solving than their wilderness counterparts. That makes sense. We're creating all sorts of challenges for them to overcome to get all that delicious compost and garbage. And pet keeping of raccoons is a thing in Toronto. We've seen a guy walking down the street with his pet raccoon, sort of flaunting his illegal raccoon ownership. And Toronto has always had a ironic affection for the trash panda. At 2015 at Yonge and Church, which is very downtown, a raccoon died, and it took a while for Toronto Public Works to come and remove Conrad from the sidewalk. If you know Toronto Public Works, this story is unsurprising. And he became posthumously a worldwide internet sensation as people took photos of Conrad and named him Conrad and surrounded him with flowers and stuff. And our iconic, ironic love of the raccoon can be seen by now. Now in 2025, 10 years later, a heritage plaque was put up at the site to celebrate the brief posthumous viral fame of Conrad the raccoon. We now have a new invasive animal situation, though, because coyotes are on the march. And in very, very downtown areas, there are now signs up warning you what to do when you encounter a coyote and how what to do to not get attacked by the coyote. Don't run away is one of the main tips. Stand your ground and look large. And one might say, is this curtains for the raccoon? Are the coyotes going to take care of the raccoon population? And it's sort of a swallow to fly situation. And the answer to that is nope. Coyotes and raccoons, they get along fine. Raccoons are too large for coyotes to think about preying upon. And therefore, sometimes they're seen, even in the wild, they peacefully coexist. They will be seen foraging side by side as animal friends. You might wonder if Raccoon City from the Resident Evil franchise is a reference to Toronto. And the answer is sadly no, although one of the movies comes relatively close by having the Montreal skyline subbing for the imaginary science fiction city of Raccoon City. So yes, indeed, we do encounter raccoons on a regular basis. Even as we speak, we've been procrastinating on planting our planters in our garden on our third floor deck because there's some raccoon poop to deal with. And as we suggested, that's a hazmat situation. That deck was rebuilt a few years ago because there was a space under the deck that was a perfect raccoon den, and therefore we had raccoons wreaking havoc. So after our deck was fixed, that solved the problem insofar as they then went down and started hanging out on the deck below us, annoying our neighbors instead. Sometimes we will see young raccoons wrestling each other on the wall around our deck. That's very entertaining. I blamed the raccoons once for ripping up my barbecue cover. And then I thought to myself, that's ridiculous. Why would they ever do? Why am I blaming the raccoons? And then I went out and there were some raccoons swinging on it. So they absolutely helped rip the barbecue cover. During the pandemic, they raided our kitchen. Remember those that short period of the pandemic where you couldn't even get flour? You weren't allowed to go out to get flour. And so we ordered some from shuttered restaurants and had them in bags. And the raccoons, I guess, were also doing sourdough starters. So they came into the kitchen and got flour all over the place. And so we have to remember to always close our screen door when we're not in the kitchen or the raccoons will come in. And in fact, one day we were out on our deck. It was heat wave, was so hot that we looked over and then just right next to us on the deck, not even on the outer rim of the deck where we sometimes hear them scrabbling, there was a big old raccoon flopped belly up, basically lolling with its tongue out in the heat. And basically he just looked at us and went, we're just going to pretend this is okay, right? And we looked at him, oh yeah, sure. And so we hung out with raccoon for an afternoon on a really hot day. Was he trying to become a pet? He didn't follow up, but possibly.
Well, you know, sometimes you meet someone on a summer hangout, you think there's a vibe, but there's not a vibe. That's just how it works.
Yeah. You never get in touch later. Friend of the show, Lynn Hardy, lived in Toronto for a year, and she was very vexed by raccoons. They would grab the improperly secured food waste of her downstairs neighbor on their deck and then climb up to her top floor deck to consume it and poop in their little pooping area and drink the water that dripped off her air conditioner. And so accordingly, I've also put raccoons into the Yellow King in This Is Normal Now. Raccoons, which of course are already wearing masks, start appearing wearing pallid masks, ceramic right. masks on their face. And those are harbinger of creepy Carcosan activities occurring.
Well, on a note of Carcosan threat, then, I suppose we can leave Toronto and its totem beast, I guess, behind and move into a different hut that will probably not poop on your deck. Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep this podcast's organic recyclables properly secured by joining beloved Patreon backers
Bart Malio,
Josh King,
Keelan O'Hay,
Drung Boy,
and John Rogers. The teetering sound of books precariously perched on top of one another tell us we're once more looking at Ken's bookshelf. This, of course, is a segment where Ken has gone out into the world and come back having legally purchased a number of exciting books, which we will vicariously enjoy and in some cases put on our reading lists. And this time around, Ken, you deprived other book buyers in Michigan of some prized treasures. And perhaps because of the company, this is a even more mystical than usual list of books.
Yes, the majority of these books were purchased in the good company of beloved friend of the show, Daniel Harms, the original, the OG consulting occultist. And we had a great time going to various bookstores in the area. I had already gone to David's Books in Ypsilanti, but we went to Mott and Bailey in Ann Arbor, which was new to me. Dawn Treader Books, which is also in Ann Arbor and is one of my faves. We both discovered Toadvine together, thanks to someone on Blue Sky. John King Books in Detroit is A Bridge Too Far, five-story warehouse full of books that many of them have not been opened since the McKinley administration. They have a northern annex in Ferndale, which is much more accessible, and so we accessed it. And then finally, Ferndale also had a library bookstore where we polished it off. So we had a good time in the greater Ann Arbor area. And
did you have to wrestle anything out of Daniel's hands, or did you have a protocol for who got what?
It's not how we roll. We would show each other our treasures and nod and either seethe inwardly or plan to purchase it later. And then sometimes the treasure would say, it's less treasury than I thought it was. And then the other of us would snap it up. But yeah, it was just a wonderful two subs find more with Sonar than one sub does. It's just a great time book shopping with Dan. Lovely time.
Well, then let's get our listeners inwardly seething with Archives in the Ancient World by Ernst Posner.
Yeah, Archives in the Ancient World is a book by a archivist, Ernst Posner. He was the president of the Society of American Archivists. You can't ask for better than that. And this is the kind of book that I'm kind of surprised I didn't even think existed, but obviously, and it is a little surprising it took until, you know, this century, I guess, for Ernst Posner to do it. But it is, you read about, you know, what was the palace library in Babylon like? Well, we know because we found it. So sometimes they found the libraries with books in, sometimes they found the building and they said, well, papyrus scroll takes up such and such amount of space. So we know that this archive could have held such and such number of records. And that's the kind of information that Ernst gives us for a variety of cultures, the Pharaonic Egypt, Greece, Persia, Ptolemaic and Roman Egypt, and both Republican and regular Rome, plus all the way back to, as I said, your clay tablets in your archives at Babylon and Ashur and elsewhere. So it's a terrific work of specialty scholarship by, I guess, a specialist better equipped to understand it than most people. So well done, Ernst Posner.
Next up, we have The Golden Antilles by Timothy Severin.
Yeah, Timothy Severin is like if Thor Heyerdahl weren't crazy and racist. Severin likes to retrace great voyages. So he has the Brendan voyage, maybe the one that you know most, or he did the Odyssey. And this is him sailing around in the Caribbean in a period authentic pirate sloop, and also using that as an excuse to combine travel narrative and stories of cool pirates who sailed around the Caribbean back in the ancient times. So you've got Thomas Gage, you've got Walter Raleigh, you've got Lionel Wafer. He's new to me. So lots of good pirate stories, lots of good travel. Timothy Severin's always a good time. And it does actually help, I think, to read about some sort of nautical exploit by someone who has sailed the territory that is involved. I think that sort of enriches the discussion a good bit.
Let's move on to the Militaria Tranche with Battlegrounds, Geography and the History of Warfare by Michael Stevenson.
Yeah, this is from the good people at National Geographic. It's basically takes a bunch of geographic features and then picks 2 to 3 battles that explicate them. So for plains, you have Alexander at Issus, you have Little Bighorn, and you have El Alamein. For islands, you have Malta, 1565. You have Crete in 1941. And you have Sulphur Island, which is to say Iwo Jima, in 45. So over and over and over, bays and harbors, peninsulas, and then places that are so god-awful that their geography is basically gone. So we're talking about Passchendaele, we're talking about Verdun, and we're talking about Stalingrad. And the degree to which the natural geography or even the built geography is overturned just by the chaos of war. So it's a good set of basically essays on single battles told from the perspective of what did the geography do to constrain the battle. I don't think there's anything there that's super revolutionary or super new, but as Robert Kelly points out in the intro, it is wild that it's taken this long for a book at all like this to exist. So there we are.
Paddy Doherty brings us The Khyber Pass, A History of Empire and Invasion.
Yeah, this is basically a military history of the Khyber Pass. And if the Khyber Pass is the narrow pass from basically Afghanistan into India or into Pakistan now, and starting with the Persians and ending with, I guess, the Taliban, you have a bunch of people who have gone through it with a bloodshed or fleeing bloodshed on their minds. And I've got a military history of Afghanistan, so this is the military history of the part of Afghanistan that the rest of the world cares about. So a nice compilation piece. I don't know how incisive the analysis is because I haven't read it, but it's certainly a good topic.
Here's a self-explanatory one. Hastings to Culloden, Battles of Britain by Peter Young and John Adair.
Yeah, this is famous or important battles that happen on the island of Great Britain and that happen since the creation of the modern Kingdom of England in 1066. So none of the battles of Arthur, none of the battles of Alfred or the others, Anglo-Saxons against the Danes. Like it says, we start with Hastings. And after Culloden in 1745, there hasn't been a important battle on the island of Britain, that being Britain's considered policy, I think, since then. So, yeah, it's a sort of a thing that you don't actually see that much, because even specialist books on, say, the English Civil War don't really treat them as what is Marston Moor or wherever else in the context of moving strategically through the island. And that is the great, I think, contribution of this book. This is, I think, a second edition of an earlier version. So it's got even more thoughts. And in many cases, they went out and they looked at the putative battlefield and said, nope, no way it was here. It was obviously over here where this big hill is. And many times they're right. So good for them.
In keeping with the policy of military historians to have book titles that explain what the books are about, SPA 124 Lafayette Escadrille, American Volunteer Airmen in World War I by John Gutman.
This is another one of those wonderful Osprey Aviation Elite series books. They're a little thicker than the normal Osprey, but again, Lafayette Escadrille is the American volunteers who fought for France before we entered the war in 17 and, you know, covered America with glory and covered France with dead German planes. So good for us and good for the book is good for anything that you're going to do that's a World War One type adventure thing, whether it's dinosaur World War One or regular World War One, I would say.
Now the last one that you'll have to put in your military section, The Return of the Galen King, History, Law, and Rebellion in Colonial Burma by Maitri Aung Thuynh.
Yeah, the Galen Rebellion happened in 1930. It was 30 and 31. There's a guy named Seya San who led this rebellion, and it sort of had a mystical component. It sort of had a nationalistic component. And this is I strongly suspect, a tiresome academic yes, but, and well actually-ing of the Galen King Rebellion. But it is the only book on the Galen King Rebellion that I've ever seen. And when you talk about any sort of ruction in the 30s, you're talking about a Trail of Cthulhu possibility, and you always like to see the hated British getting one in the eye. So worth picking up, I would say.
Now we're going to move into the Tradecraft Hut, and we've got an overview title, and I guess you'll explain why this overview warranted inclusion. This is Terry Crowdy's The Enemy Within, A History of Espionage.
Yeah, as I think I've mentioned before, my criteria for a overview of espionage history is how long does it take before you get to World War II? Because that's where most of these histories hit their stride. And this book goes to about page 337, and it hasn't gotten to World War II until, I want to say, somewhere in the early 200s. So 2/3 of this book is pre-World War II, which is great for a history of espionage. So I'm just rewarding Terry Crowdy, I guess, at a remove by picking up his book, because he gives an actual history of espionage, I suppose, just 20th century easy to research espionage. So good for you, Terry Crowdy.
If your library had a things that didn't work out section, you would shelve Coffee with Hitler, The Story of the Amateur Spies Who Tried to Civilize the Nazis by Charles Spicer in that section.
Yeah, this is back in the 30s, It used to be considered that if there was a regime that was clearly hostile to you, the thing to do was to set up a lobbying group and make nice with it and claim that it never wanted anything bad. Obviously, no one does that now, but in the 30s, people would do it. And these guys, I think, partly from genuine pacifism, partly from wanting to turn the Nazis after the Russians and leave Britain alone, were sort of trying to explore common interests between the Nazi regime and the British Empire. And it didn't work out, as history will record, but it's an interesting sort of case study of this sort of approach and the notion that even though they're doing this, they're still also working to some extent with MI6 is, I think, the interesting wrinkle in what would otherwise be just another sordid story of the Astor Group. These aren't those guys. These are simultaneously more dedicated and less fascist-y bunch of guys. And so perhaps more interesting on that basis.
Right. If they're doing it in a, this might not work out, so we're also going to compile a dossier fashion, that is kind of admirable. And the thing is, there isn't a whole shelf full of books on diplomatic friendship initiatives that worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't track those.
Not on my shelves, anyway.
Let's move to The Crime Blotter and Thug, The True Story of India's Murderous Cult by Mike Dash.
Mike Dash is one of those authors. He is a compulsive researcher. He has a debunker's mind, but he also knows that the reason you picked up the book is for all the exciting stuff that he's probably going to debunk. So he is really good to read on whatever topic crosses his radar. And the Thuggee are, of course, you know, a mystical society, an organized crime group, a case study in counterinsurgency and crime suppression. Lots of good stuff to be gleaned from the Thugs. And when Mike Dash says, all right, everybody, enough of this nonsense, I'm going to tell you what's going on with the Thuggee, that's when I pay attention. So any Mike Dash book is a good book. And I'm sure this is another good book by Mike Dash on that very topic.
From Stephen Johnson, The Infernal Machine, A True Story of Dynamite Terror and the Rise of the Modern Detective.
Yeah, the anarchist dynamiting spate that sort of began in the late 1880s, early 1890s in Europe, went into full flower in America, a last gasp, if you will, from, say, 1914 to 1919, which eventually triggered the Red Scare and got a bunch of people deported, many of them born in America, as it happens, but there we are. So this is about that dynamiting campaign, and I think specifically the campaign in New York, because our central character is Arthur Woods, the commissioner of the New York police, who suddenly has to deal with all of these anarchists setting off bombs on Wall Street and in the houses of millionaires. And New York then and now prides itself on having many houses of millionaires and also Wall Street. So clearly that is a problem that could not be left unsolved. And how they solved it, that's the burden of the book.
Here's a very patriotic title for you, Ken. American Gunfight, The Plot to Kill Harry Truman and the Shootout That Stopped It, by Stephen Hunter and John Bainbridge Jr.
And people will remember Stephen Hunter as the author of the Bob Lee Swagger series of sniper thrillers, some of which have been made into movies, others of which have been left to thrill. This is a real-life gunfight. It is a gunfight between the Secret Service and Puerto Rican nationalist terrorists who attempted to kill Harry Truman. And I think that this is one of those assassination attempts on a president and terrorist attacks on the Capitol that is sort of been memory hold, or people have forgotten that it ever happened. But it's always good to have a guy who writes well about gunplay discussing this 1950 attack on America, or at least on Harry Truman, who at that time, I would say, was certainly America.
Right. Puerto Rican nationalists are just sort of outside the ideological framework for everybody. So I guess that's a big part of why that exciting sounding story has been forgotten. One thing that is not forgotten around here is the necessity of paying homage to our beautiful sponsors. So let's listen to an exciting hand-tooled advertisement before we come back for the more mystical half of the list. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. And we're back for the artsy side of mysticism with W.B. Yeats, The Man in the Milieu by Keith Aldred.
I picked this up because I do not have, well, I may be wrong. I did not have, to my knowledge, a full-on Yeats biography. I have books about Yeats, lots of books about Yeats, but I don't think any of them are sort of the straight, you know, birth to death bio. And Keith Aldred wrote one and had the misfortune, apparently, to write one that came out the same year as a much better Yeats bio, which maybe explains why this one was available used for $7. But I picked it up because, as I say, I don't have any Yeats bios. So for now, at least, this is the best Yeats bio that I own. And Yeats, first of all, transcendent literary genius, but second of all, Golden Dawn. So I don't think I need to justify owning a Yeats bio to anyone.
Now, often we'll have a book in the bookshelf where the question is merely a Shakespeare quote is the title, or is it about Shakespeare? And this time that's Angels and Ministers of Grace Defend Us by Gregory William Manck.
Yeah, my bad, Robin, for not including the subtitle, More Dark Alleys of Classic Horror Cinema. This is a Macfarlane Press book, and as you know, Macfarlane Press lives for the devoted scholar who is not going to get published through a university, and so this is a guy who is basically a film historian with the maybe a tick towards the gossipy, interviewee side of film historian, as opposed to the academic culture critic side. And this is him writing about a bunch of horror movies and that era's actors. So we've got works on Murders in the Rue Morgue, Rasputin and the Empress, Island of Lost Souls, Bride of Frankenstein, Werewolf of London, Mad Love, Tower of London, the 1941 Jekyll and Hyde, and the House of Frankenstein, and the long, sad final act of Basil Rathbone. So a story in every chapter, and basically it was well priced, and so I thought, I will gamble on this guy. Plus, he's writing about Werewolf of London, House of Frankenstein, and Bride of Frankenstein. So my subject matter interests already on point.
The next book says that last book had monsters, but doesn't have giant monsters. And that's The Big Book of Japanese Giant Monster Movies, The Lost Films by John LeMay. What could be lost about kaiju movies?
Some of them are lost in the sense that they never got made. Some of them are lost in the sense that, no, literally, just like how Britain filmed a bunch of stuff on kinescope and then lost it, so did Japan. And some of them are not so much lost as never got released outside Japan. And so it's still fun to know about. But if you are looking for the Gnostic Gospels of Godzilla, this, I think, is the book to go after.
Moving away from the artistic into the spine chilling, we come to Ghosts in the Middle Ages, The Living and the Dead in Medieval Society by Jean-Claude Schmitt.
Yeah, this is a considerably more reputable type book, and it is by a real medievalist. And I guess this is a guy who said, man, everyone keeps mentioning ghosts in like legal documents and things. What did they mean? And digs into it. And what they meant was ghosts. And he has a grand old time as a medieval scholar of saying, well, are these revenant ghosts? Did they come back in the flesh? Did people think of them as coming from hell? What's the story with that? So he has a straight up medieval cultural legal perspective on what ghosts were. And that's very interesting because I think we're sort of programmed to think of ghosts as M.R. James thought of them. Nothing wrong with that. But this is the kind of book that M.R. James would have read before he wrote A Ghost Story. So I like that.
But my question with this next book, The British Folklorists, A History by Richard M. Dorson, is how many of the people covered in it have been side-eyed by Ronald Hutton?
I would say probably many of them. This is by the Dean of American Folklorists, which I have to hope is a diss, Richard M. Dorson, has written this book about the sort of Victorian era. So we're talking about Andrew Lang and Edwin Sidney Hartland, George Gomme, Alfred Nutt, Max Müller, who we all know, Edward Claude, and Joseph Jacobs. And so this is all manner of early, and with the exception of Lang and to a lesser extent Müller, forgotten British folklorists. But these are the guys who are fanning out, collecting all those stories, and then trying desperately to fit them into either a Fraserian or an evolutionary angle, and therefore are looking at folklore wrong, but they are the only people looking at it at all. And so that is, I think, where Dorson is maybe going to have a little fellow feeling as a fellow folklorist. And so it's just a great, interesting milieu. Obviously, it's rich in game possibility from ballad hunters on down. So well worth checking out, I think.
So there's a paragraph break in your list, which leads me to suspect that we're heading fully into the lands of Wu. Let's see if that's true with The Silvery Treasure, The Great Goddess Rediscovered, by Michael Dames.
Yeah, this guy is a guy who goes and bothers ancient stones. I don't know if he's a credited archaeologist or even a credible archaeologist, but I do know that his theory is that Silbury Hill, which is in Wessex, is a physical embodiment, or was considered a physical embodiment, of the goddess. That they built this hill over her, and then they built this temple around her. And that begins as a pretty radical notion. And so I think the combination of goddess energy and archaeology is why it is in occult archaeology as opposed to just regular wrong archaeology.
This one, we can tell from the title, is in that section. Shocking secrets of antiquity, racial wars of Bronze Age, unusual artifacts, technolithic engineering, and the two cataclysms that buried history, by Jason Brashears.
Yeah, this is, I think, began maybe as a series of blog posts. The subtitle says 400 pages of amazing data citing 247 books and reports. So he is excitedly involving a lot of stuff. This is one of those go big or go home type books. It's got your Nibirus, it's got your Nephilims, it's got your pole shifts, it's got two separate floods, regular and Ogyges. There's serpents. There's all manner of stuff. And I'm just going to quote a bit from page 346 in the chapter entitled 600 Year Epochs of Anunnaki Chronology. So we begin with our Anunnaki chronology, 3439 BC, the Anunnaki descended. Then 600 years before that, we captured the moon. There was no moon before about 4000 BC. Interesting to know. And then down through Noah, Joseph, David, etc. All your big Bible guys. And here's Brashear. That some of these events never happened does not matter. That David was borrowed from a Canaanite epic about a giant slayer does not make a difference. That Noah was born at the beginning of a 600-year period and was still alive 600 years later when the Great Flood occurred, whether true or not, does not matter. The veracity of these accounts has little to do with what is occurring. And my goodness.
Future events will occur in the future.
Right. The veracity of these accounts does not matter to what is occurring. That is up there with all the facts in this movie are true. So yes, for that alone,
whether I paid my rent has little to do with whether my rent has been paid.
Exactly. So stop trying to catch me out on my rant. Love that guy. Probably don't love that guy. In real life, he's probably a horrible person, but I bought it used, so whatever.
Well, we don't know, but yeah. There's entertainment value.
Yep.
So, Secrets of the Waitsmith Tarot, The True Story of the World's Most Popular Tarot, is by Marcus Katz and Tally Goodwin.
Yeah, this goes into some depth on our beloved friend of the show, Pamela Coleman-Smith, talks about Waite, and then goes into where did Waite get the pieces that go into the tarot card descriptions, and where did Pamela Coleman Smith get the depiction? So is there a prior painting, a prior image that maybe either Waite turned her onto or that she drew from through her own creativity? We don't have a lot of their working documents. We barely have any evidence that it was done at all. We have a letter from Pamela Smith saying, I just finished a big commission for little money, which is talking about these cards. And we have a little bit from Waite on the topic. We have his books, but we don't have the sort of the working documents. So this is an attempt by Katz and Goodwin to recreate those working documents, or at least to sort of dig into the influences on the imagery of the, what they call, I think correctly, the Waite Smith Tarot. Let's stop giving the publisher any credit at all, frankly. And it's also very attractive. It's from our good friends at Llewellyn. So they know what they're doing when they put together a book. So I would say, as a book of tarot scholarship, on the reputable end, the reason it's here is it's about tarot, for goodness sake.
Now, usually the last title in the list is a doozy, but Shocking Secrets of Antiquity only came in third, and the anodyne-sounding Carl Germer Selected Letters 1928 to 1962, edited by David Schumacher, Andrew Farrell, and Stefan Voss, comes in the coveted final spot. Ken, what's weird about this?
Well, Carl Germer was Aleister Crowley's successor as the head of the AA and OTO. And I believe he either founded or was a big wheel in the Fraternitas Saturnii, which was a ritual magic group in Germany. And then when the German government outlawed ritual magic, he had to sort of go on the hop. And these are his letters, mostly to other people complaining about how they're not doing Crowley right, because that's what you are selected for if you're Carl Germer. And the reason he's there is because that's the end. That's the sort of tag end. We started with ancient times, went through even more pretend ancient times. Then we come into modernity with the tarot, and now we have Carl Germer. So that's why he's holding down the coveted pole position, is because Aleister Crowley personally picked him to hold down the coveted pole position of guy left holding the bag in Germany.
Right. It's got the most mystical cease and desist letters you could possibly hope for.
Exactly.
Well, this podcast is not going to cease and desist because our beloved Patreon backers are keeping us going. So we'll be back with another exciting installment a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Reward this podcast with continued existence alongside such public-spirited backers as...
Merrick Shinkariel.
Jan Zaleski.
Andy M. Young.
Dave Barr.
And Derek Yates.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time, and once again, we will talk about stuff.